Last night was a beautiful night. Ed and Jane, knowing Kathy and I, our friends, came over. We're planning a trip, kind of an old people's long service leave thing for next year, a trip to Canada. It'll be great fun. I don't know if you're a rugby league fan, but last night was a big night. My friend Ed had been a South Sydney supporter all his life, and you have to get used to disappointment sometime. So we watched the Roosters win. Look, if you live in the eastern suburbs and you're not a Roosters supporter, there's still time to jump on and be a fair weather fan, okay? Because next week we beat the Storm. Anyway, we watched. That was great fun. Now, why was that so sweet? Kathy and I have been friends with Ed and Jane for almost 35 years. Right? We've seen our kids grow up. We've seen heartache and we've seen our parents die and all sorts of things. But in so many ways, lived life together for, well, nearly 35 years. And friendship, particularly old friends in a way, is one of the sweetest things in life. I wonder if you might stop and think this morning, how many real friends, like really good friends, do you have? I wonder sometimes if we take that for granted. How many really good friends do you have? Because this week I've been thinking about that. This is the job I got from Toby about friendship. And I went to psychology today and, I thought, what's the marks of a good friendship? So what do? Well, you Google it, up it comes. Here we go, psychology today. So the marks of a good friend, that they're trustworthy, honest, dependable, loyal, empathetic, non-judgmental, a good listener, and will support you as a friend in good times and bad times. Okay, right, yep, all pretty obvious. But there's one that they missed, and it's very important, and that is a good friend is someone who will tell you hard things, even if you don't really want to hear it. They'll tell you things about yourself that you don't really want to hear. So Proverbs chapter 27, verse 6 in the Old Testament, wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. It's your good friends will say hard things to you. And this week I've thought, in the kindness of God, I reckon I've got four or five really good friends. I kind of put St. Catherine in a separate class, but four or five good friends, and I've worked out that they've been friends, some for 20, some for 30, some for 40 years. Now, I know that's not an option open to a lot of you, but hang around, it'll happen. It's worth asking the question, though, are you a good friend to others? Because friendship costs. It costs in terms of time. It's often not convenient to spend time with people, or they'll do things that drive you mad, or you'll have to forgive them for things, or when they get it wrong. Or, the old saying, a friend in need is a nuisance, okay? And so it costs. Anyway, today we're going to look at, briefly, at I think one of the greatest friendships in the Bible. One of the greatest friendships you'll ever hear about, and that is of David and Jonathan. Now, over the last few weeks, we've looked through the book of 1 Samuel. And by the way, if you're not used to the Bible, I hope you might read 1 Samuel. It's whatever you believe about it, it's just a beautiful piece of literature as it paints these pictures of the characters so beautifully. We've heard lots about David. You may not know much about Jonathan. Jonathan is a very impressive man, very impressive. Even if you just want the executive summary, just flick through 1 Samuel, about chapters 13, 14, 18, 20, 31. And you'll get the beautiful pen portrait of him. He's a leader, he's loyal, he's humble, he's compassionate, he's strong. He takes his faith in God very seriously, like he takes his oaths in the name of God. He heads off into battle almost on his own with the Philistines, asking God for guidance. He's a great warrior in terms of the description of how he goes in battle. Remarkable. And the other thing is, he's loyal to his dad, but he stands up to his father as well for what's right. Very, very impressive. But more than that, he is the heir to the throne. He is the son of King Saul, who's the first king of Israel. Now, do you think being heir to the throne might play on your mind occasionally? Okay, forget the guy at the back on the left, but we've got the front, the older man at the front, the guy on the right behind him, and the little boy. What do they have in common? They are all heirs to the throne of the United Kingdom. Prince Charles, Prince William, and the little guy is Prince George. Now, my guess is that Prince Charles had about 70 years to think about it. Prince William, Prince George may not spend a lot of time thinking about it. But the other two, man, that is the biggest thing in their life. They are heirs to the throne. So Jonathan is the son of King Saul. King Saul becomes the first king of Israel about 1000 BC. Here's a map of the kingdom of Israel at the time of Saul. Now, you probably can't see the specifics. Israel is the orange. Now, the reason I show you this, by the way, is I'll keep saying it. This stuff really happened. We're going to dig up things about this in archaeology. This isn't Star Wars or Mordor. The orange is Israel, but you notice Israel is actually surrounded by enemies. There's the Canaanites in the top left. There's the Moabites on the right. The Ammonites, the Amalekites, all enemies. And particularly, I love this, Philistia. The Philistines lived in five city-states there on the southwest. In fact, you'll still hear about Gaza and some of the other cities in the Middle East. They were more advanced than Israel. They had Israel very much kind of under the thumb at the time. And the people asked for a king, in some ways for the wrong reasons. They asked for a king so they'd be like the other nations. They asked for a king who'd keep them safe, a king who'd be able to defend them. And it's very much a rejection of God's rule of the nation. So God gives them, if you've been coming along, as you know, God gives them the king they want, in some ways the king they deserve. Saul, who's tall, handsome, charismatic, and who in the end becomes addicted to power, status, and praise. And that's one of the things as you read 1 Samuel, it's very hard to have power and status and to not become addicted to it. Very hard, very hard. Saul's disobedient to God. God ultimately rejects him. And now I think I could say this carefully. Here's the irony in 1 Samuel. Jonathan would have made a wonderful king. Jonathan had all of the stuff that Saul didn't. Jonathan could have stepped into the gap there and done a great job, except God had other plans. God chose, as we say, a man after his own heart. Through Samuel, the prophet, God speaking to Saul. But now your kingdom will not endure, to King Saul. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command. The idea of the Lord, after the Lord's own heart, is more that this is the one that God would choose. And we saw a few weeks ago, God sends the prophet Samuel in chapter 16 to the home of Jesse near Bethlehem, and God plucks kind of a boy out of nowhere, a shepherd boy called David, and Samuel anoints him. And in the Old Testament, the idea of being the anointed one is you're the one that God's chosen, and the other way of saying that is the Messiah, the anointed one or the Messiah. And God chooses David to be the Messiah. Now, about 3 weeks ago, Toby took us through when this shepherd boy chosen from the middle of nowhere steps out of obscurity and rescues the nation by killing the giant Goliath. Now, I know you've all heard of David and Goliath, but it's not just that kicking the winning goal in last night's rugby league game. God really does use David to save the nation, because if Goliath hadn't been stopped, the Philistines would have just rolled over the whole nation. It really was life and death, and God uses David to save them. And pretty soon it becomes obvious to everybody that God has his hand on this young man, David, that he's the chosen one, the Messiah. But here's what I want you to see. If you look in your program or look on in the Bible, if you've got it open, at 1 Samuel 18, there's very different reactions to that. God's chosen this young man to be the next king. He's the one, he's the Messiah, the anointed one. Look at the different reactions. So from 1 Samuel 18, verse 5, David kills Goliath. Saul obviously takes notice of him. Saul keeps David with him. From verse 5, whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, that would be Goliath, The women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. Do you know Saul's problem? It's not all about me. Now you can call it envy, or here's six words that I wish I could learn properly, and you might like to think about it too. Theodore Roosevelt, the American president from just over 100 years ago, said this: "Comparison is the thief of joy." Now, isn't that true? If you take away nothing else from what the old bald guy said this morning, that's worth taking away. And that's what Saul's problem is. He's the king, yes, but compares himself to David. And in verse 8, the word for anger is the idea of burning. And that burning inside him turns into, well, we'll see in a moment, actually turns him murderous. Now, that's Saul. And you know what? It's actually understandable. I'm not saying it's good, but it's understandable, that reaction, that kind of envy, what about me? Yeah. But Jonathan's reaction is very hard to get your head around. Look at chapter 18, verse 1. After David had finished talking with Saul, this is after he's killed Goliath, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his bow and his belt. I'll read that again properly. Along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. You see, he loved him. It became obvious about what God had chosen this man, and yet Jonathan embraces him. You see the word there for covenant. He loved him. Yes, covenant. The Hebrew word for covenant, barit, it's very significant in the Bible. Now, it's the idea of a promises made and like an alliance or a promise about the future. Now, often it's between God and people. In fact, the whole Bible's about the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, or the Old Testament, the New Testament. That's how important it is. And often with the making of a covenant, it involved shedding blood. Sometimes they'd kill an animal and separate it, and then walk up and down. The two parties would walk up and down between the animals, and it's the idea of if we break this covenant, we'll end up like that. Kind of, we will die. Or the shedding of blood showed how significant this agreement or promises was between the parties. So you've got the arrangement between God and his people is talked about as a covenant. And then sometimes a covenant's made between nations, rulers, or sometimes individuals. And here you've got David and Jonathan making a covenant with one another to love, support, care for each other. But look at verse 4. David turns up, he kills Goliath. He turns up with his shepherd's bag and a sling and not much else. He's not rich, he's just a shepherd boy. And what does verse 4 say? Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. Now, if you've read 1 Samuel really carefully, the sword thing is a big deal. You think, why? Well, let me show you. The Philistines had Israel so much under the thumb and under control that they stopped them having proper weapons. So we're told this. Not a blacksmith, this is earlier, okay, a few years before this, not a blacksmith could be found in the whole land of Israel because the Philistines had said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines to have their plough points and mattocks and axes and sickles sharpened. So on the day of battle, not a soldier with Saul and Jonathan had a sword or spear in his hand, only Saul and his son Jonathan had them. So everyone else has had to turn up with their, you know, with a spade or a shovel or whatever it was you had. Jonathan's had this precious, precious thing, and he gives it to David. So they promise to love, protect, support each other. And part of that covenant, it's like he understands you're the next king, and he gives him the signs of kingship. How does he do that? There's one other part as well to the covenant. In the ancient world, well, actually, it's not too ancient. I'm just going to put this on mute, but you. In the ancient world, well, it's not so ancient, it happens often too. When someone took over a kingdom, when they became ruler, the first thing that they did was to kill off all the other pretenders to the throne. So you take over the previous royal family, you just kill them all so there's no more threat to your power. And in chapter 20, which is another key part of the friendship between Jonathan and David, listen to what Jonathan says to David. Jonathan knows that David will be king, and so Jonathan says, "But show me unfailing kindness, like the Lord's kindness, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." He's saying, "I know you'll be king. Let my family live on, please." All right. Well, somehow Jonathan accepts David's the chosen one. He actually embraces the idea. All right, that's it. Next point. There's a cost to friendship. Over the coming years, becomes obvious, more and more obvious to King Saul that David will be the next king. Saul has a different solution to that to what Jonathan does. If you have a look at your program or the Bible, look at 1 Samuel chapter 20 and from verse 30. So Saul's worked this out. David's going to be the next king, or that's the way it looks. Chapter 20, verse 30. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse," that being David, "to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die." Now, if you're a parent, I reckon, or if you've had parents, which covers most of us, I reckon you can understand that frustration. Saul's saying, "Son, don't you get it? This is our family, our dynasty, and you're going to be king. And while ever David, it's what you really want for your children shows what you really want. If you've got kids, if you want to know what your values really are, it's what you want for your children will show that." And you can see what Saul wants. His solution? Well, just kill David. Look at verse 32. Jonathan's answer. "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father. So he stands up for David. David's innocent. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. I guess that would communicate something. Here's a portrait, or part of a portrait, on King Saul throwing the spear at dinner by Giovanni Francesco Barbareri. Yeah, it's a great name, in the 1600s. King Saul had a kind of a habit of throwing spears at people, which I think it was nice to be a dinner guest, but just made for kind of nervous meals. Anyway, fortunately, he wasn't a great shot. So Saul can't accept it. Jonathan does. Now, why? Why? Jonathan's a person of faith. Jonathan actually trusts the God of Israel and trusts God's choices. He's a friend. He's loyal to his father, and he is very loyal to Jonathan, but in the end, his trust in his Messiah, in the Anointed One, drives a wedge even into the family. And Jonathan understands something I think is very hard to learn, and I still haven't learned it, that he's not the center of everything, that it's not all about him, that God has other plans. Jonathan's still important, but Jonathan's not the center of everything. And it's interesting, as you read the story, Jonathan's the one who's content. Jonathan's the one who's strong. Jonathan's the one who's wise. Jonathan's the one who's loyal. And yet he stands beside the Messiah and he realizes, actually, it's all about David. The story has a sad ending in one way. Jonathan dies fighting bravely to defend his father and the nation on Mount Gilboa. Mount Gilboa is way up in the north near the Valley of Jezreel. He dies in chapter 31, it's reported. What does Mount Gilboa look like? Oh, here we go. You can actually see it's quite a high mountain that comes up off the plain. and the Philistines come sweep up the mountain, and Jonathan's killed. The same day that his father dies as well. And so it's a sad story. If you keep reading the New Testament, Jonathan didn't get a kingdom here, but the promise is he'll be part of an eternal kingdom. And did David remember when David became king, did he remember his covenant with Jonathan? Yes. Let me just read you a little story from 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 9, David is king of the whole nation finally. And what does David do about Jonathan and Saul's family? Well, he remembers. The king asked David, "Is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?" Ziba, who was one of the servants, answered the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet." Mephibosheth was crippled. His nurse panicked when the news of Saul's death came, and she fell, and both his feet or legs were broken. So we're told, when Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, "Mephibosheth, at your service," he replied. "Don't be afraid," David said to him, "for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." So David remembered. Okay. Well, let's tie up some loose ends. What does this mean to us? Well, I think I could say, first of all, regardless of your spiritual beliefs, and I don't assume we're all followers of Jesus, you may be just rubbing your chin thinking about it. Regardless of your spiritual beliefs, it's worth asking the question, am I a good friend? Am I a good friend? One of my daughters, who will remain nameless, when she was in early high school, used to talk about spare friends. They were like your real friends that you had, but then if your real friends weren't around, you had to have two or three spare friends that you could kind of hang around with. Now she's grown out of that, and I'm not saying who she is or was, but you ever operate with the spare friends thing? Are you a good friend? Because friendship costs, doesn't it? Friendship costs time, energy, forgiveness. Who are your real friends? Are you guilty sometimes if it's all about me? It's worth asking the question. But what about if you're a follower of Jesus, or if you're thinking about it, how does this all work? Well, this actually fits beautifully into the New Testament. The way that the Bible works is the Bible gives you patterns. And so David is a pattern of the chosen one or the anointed king in the Old Testament. He's like the small M Messiah. And he's a pattern for what will happen when the capital M Messiah arrives, who is, of course, Jesus. And so the question you can't help but ask, and I'm sure you're meant to ask because you read the story, is, will you respond with love and friendship to the capital M Messiah who offers you that? And so let me take you through four things that were in this story originally, the Old Testament story: covenant, love, friendship, and cost. Just quickly. Covenant, love, friendship, and cost. Because Jesus offers a covenant to us. And it's a covenant of forgiveness, a covenant that promises to give us his spirit, and it's a covenant that involved blood, a covenant that meant, well, actually his blood. And have you ever seen the Lord's Supper celebrated? How is it that Jesus explained? In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood." His blood poured out on the cross to win us forgiveness, which is poured out for you. And so the new covenant that Jesus offers. But more than that, to be Christian is not just to tick the box and say, yeah, I believe these certain doctrinal things or historical things happened. Jesus' call is to love him. Now, that's strange, isn't it? Jesus' call is to love him. It's very personal. One of the things that jumps out to me is the story where Jesus is on the beach and he's cooked the fish, and there's about seven of the disciples are there, and they meet him after he's been raised, after the resurrection, he's risen from the dead. And you might remember, you might know that Peter, the apostle, had denied Jesus three times. Look at what Jesus says, or gets, where are we? Let's see, can we do it? Here we are. Look at what Jesus does here with Peter. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" I think he means more than the other disciples. Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him a third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. And so, yeah, you can love him as you know him through his words and through his spirit. But more than that, what Jesus says, you know him as Lord, as master, but also as friend. As friend. And so the night before Jesus dies, he says to his disciples, these are very famous words. And you think about this, this is the one who is creator, Lord of the universe, judge of everyone, who offers us this. He says this, greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I've made known to you. Two ways that Jesus shows his friendship. One, that he lays down his life for us. You can't do more than that for a friend. And that he tells us his business. Like that he tells us what's going on. The way that we show friendship to Jesus, see verse 14, is to trust him. You are my friends if you do what I command. In other words, if you really trust him, yeah, you'll do what he says. Friendship with him. One last point. There's a cost to friendship, isn't there? See, Jonathan stood with God's little M Messiah, and it cost. And if we will stand with God's capital M Messiah today, it'll cost. Exactly. That's what Jesus says. He doesn't soft soap it at all. Jesus says this in Matthew's gospel. He says, for I have come to turn, and then he quotes the Old Testament prophecy of Micah. He says, I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. They're hard words, aren't they? See, if you'll identify with God's Messiah, if you are his friend, it's not that the Christian person will drive a wedge in the family or push others away, but it's other people who'll drive the wedges. And I know you stand up and follow Jesus, even within your own family that can happen. Or with colleagues at work, or with close friends, or it Jesus says it will cost. So friendship with Jesus, what does it mean? Standing with God's Messiah. And do you know what the really hard thing is? And I'm still working on it. The really hard thing is this, is realizing it's not all about me. If you want to take anything away from Jonathan, it's the fact that he realized that he embraced God's plans and God's Messiah and realized it's not all about me. And that's really hard to learn, isn't it? I'll show you a painting. It's beautiful. Narcissus, painted by Caravaggio, another Italian artist from the 1500s. Narcissus in Greek mythology was a hunter and absolutely drop-dead handsome. And he treated people with disdain because they would fall in love with him and his beauty. Now, Nemesis, who I think is one of the other Greek gods, saw this, and Nemesis led Narcissus to a pond where the water was still, and as Narcissus looked into the pond, he saw his own reflection and fell in love with it. And because he fell in love with his own reflection to the point where the unrequited love meant he lost the will to live and took his own life. And so you get narcissist, a person who has an excessive interest in or admiration of themselves, narcissists who think the world revolves around them. Folks, there's a little bit of that in all of us, isn't there? A little, I'll just say a little bit. There's a lot of it in some of us. There's a little bit of that in all of us. And it's so hard to learn the lesson that it's not all about me. And yet, friendship with the Messiah, to follow Jesus means to understand, actually, it's all about him. And I'm valued, I'm important, God cares about me, but actually, it's all about him. And life may not go the way we would have written the script. It certainly didn't for Jonathan. But to trust the Messiah as a friend is to know that in the long run, he will keep his promises and we will not miss out. You pray with me? And Father, we thank you for the wonderful example of Jonathan and David. And we ask, please, that we might all come to know friendship with your Messiah. Ask, please, we might be able to learn the hard lessons to be able to do that. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.